Let's have some fun. So it's my pleasure to introduce this morning's keynote speaker, Jonathan Chase. I don't think I've had this pleasure before, although I seem to have been working with Jonathan for a long time. If we go back to a working group at NCSIS where we were talking about meta-communities and ideas of metaversity and turnover in space and time and how connected communities are in space, I think this is sort of an appropriate backdrop to today's symposium. A brief bio about Jonathan. So Jonathan obtained a master's in 1995 from the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Utah State University. He obtained his PhD in 1998 at the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, and then he did a postdoc at the Center for Population Biology, University of California, Davis. And then from 1999 to 2002, he was assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh. And then from 2002 to 2010, professor, associate professor, and professor at Washington University, and was also director of the Tyson Research Center. Since 2012, Jonathan is senior scientist at the Biodiversity Synthesis Laboratory in St. Louis. And aside for the many, many things he's doing, he's also a senior editor at Ecology Letters. And he's currently, I believe, writing a couple of books. One, a sort of a general ecology textbook that I'm sure will become an important read for undergraduates and graduate students alike, but also working on the second version of a meta-community book for Princeton University Press, which I believe he's writing with Matthew Leibold. I think we all know Jonathan for his elegant contributions to theory and experiments. He works hard to connect those two and to perform critical tests of theory. But of course, he works on a vast range of aspects that touch upon biodiversity change and the factors that cause change and some of the consequences of biodiversity change. So I can't think of a better person to give the keynote this morning. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan to the stage.
We already have this open. Oh. That's okay. I should be able to figure this out.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks again for that wonderful introduction and for the invitation here from Andy and Tony and JP Lessard, who I've been chatting with about various things. And I'm really excited to be here to tell you about some new ideas and new thoughts that I've been working on. I also want to plug a new NCSIS-like center that I'll be moving to with my family in August in Germany, the German Integrative Center for Biodiversity Research. And there are several professorships, and there's an NCSIS-like working group scenario. And so I want to encourage people to think about maybe coming to visit Leipzig, Germany, and exploring some of these questions at a broader scale. Now, a lot of this introduction is going to be sort of a big general introduction, but I use it to sort of instigate the questions that we're interested in as biodiversity scientists. Clearly, there are many, many kinds of biodiversity scientists, and I'm going to focus more on the specific questions of abundances and, you know, numbers of species and the diversities and things like that. And these things are usually, you know, we think about diversification as sort of setting the whole thing off. Environmental factors, ecological factors like productivity and disturbance certainly play a huge role in determining the maintenance and the variation in species diversity. Of course, there are stochastic, neutral processes, drift and dispersal and so forth. And then the interspecific interactions that maybe our field started with, like competition, predation and so forth. All of these things interact, of course, in very complex ways to determine the numbers and types and varieties of species that we see. Now, clearly, we're here today to talk about this sort of extra bit, which is this impact that is occurring. We know many of these impacts occurred previously in the fossil record, but of course, today's is slightly different. It's being driven potentially by this one particular species on our planet. And then we ask the question, well, what are we doing to biodiversity? Okay, we just heard the video of this dramatic impact humans are having on biodiversity. And so what are those impacts? Well, there are clearly direct ones. Many people think maybe even influence the extinctions of some large mammals as humans traversed across the great, you know, across to North America and so forth. Global change is a huge effect. And we're altering interspecific interactions. So we're altering many of the things that we just saw influence diversity. We're changing them, and we're changing the way that we see them. And so we try to quantify now. Maybe we want to know, well, what are the important things? What are we doing to biodiversity? What are the things that matter? And so a very well-cited, excessively well-cited study, Dave Wilkov and colleagues tried to quantify some of these. And so the main conclusion on the percentages of species that are threatened by various things was that habitat loss was the single greatest threat. Most of us still agree with that, and invasive species maybe are the second greatest threat. Well, we try to be a little bit more quantitative, a little bit more exploring some of the details here. Is there a pointer anywhere, or is that, it's not a huge deal if there isn't. It's not, it's not a big deal at all. And I can even walk over there. It's a small room. I don't know if people can hear when I'm just talking regularly, so, well, I can't really reach here. But anyway, we have quantifications. Oh, thank you very much, sir. Brilliant. We have quantifications in the terms of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, where we're trying to be a little bit more refined in our understanding of these losses. And so you see all these arrows indicating various levels of impact humans are having and different types of impacts in different places on the Earth. Again, habitat change and invasive species come out being reasonably important. But I want to point out that in this particular case, the figure being based on expert opinion maybe leaves a little bit to be desired in terms of quantification. And so now we have a ton of experiments, a ton of studies, and very sophisticated tools like meta-analysis to actually address these questions in a more quantitative way. And this is a paper that was recently published by Murphy and Romanuk, actually trying to quantify some of these things that were more qualitative in that Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. The average effect size being the sort of percent difference between a control and the impact, the effector. And so you can see, again, our buddies, habitat loss and invasive species, are having a reasonably good negative impact. And we can start partitioning these impacts. We can ask, well, what are producers doing? What are animals doing? Maybe there are different effects in boreal systems. We can now quantify and do meta-analyses that allow us to test these questions. So I want to delve a little bit deeper into one of these things and show you that I think there's some limitations to some of these analyses and the way we approach these questions in the first place. And so clearly alien species can be very important. We know great examples of brown tree snakes on Guam driving birds extinct, or avian malaria in Hawaii. In many other places, we have it in our own backyard with the zebra mussels and the emerald ash borers and the monocultures of plants that are dominating the ecosystems around us. It's really an important process. And when you look at experiments, we've all done these experiments, I've done these experiments, many people have done these experiments, we see lots of really strong evidence for these negative effect sizes. Montserrat Vila in Ecology Letters recently, a different study by Murphy and Romanuk, European studies, lots of evidence that you're getting these negative effect sizes. But the problem is that there's a counter argument here. And the counter argument, many people cite a paper by Dove Sachs, Gaines, and Jim Brown that analyzed the numbers of species that colonized islands and the numbers of species that went extinct from islands. And clearly, many more colonizations than extinctions means they're not declining in biodiversity. Jessica Gurvich and Diana Padilla wanted to explore whether the idea of Wilkov et al. Was really true in plants. They found no evidence that plants were driving other plants extinct. There's no evidence. So how can biodiversity be declining if there's no evidence for extinctions? Leading to popular press, Discover Magazine had this cover several years ago. And the scientists have gotten more into the fray. A variety of very well-known scientists started, and this was an essay published in Nature a couple of years ago, saying, hey, you know, maybe invasive species aren't such a big deal. You guys are making such a huge deal about these things. We need to start thinking a little bit more pragmatically. Of course, many folks responded quite angrily, 142 folks. Many other folks have responded. But it still makes the popular press, and it makes it seem like we really have a big debate going on in the literature and in our field about these problems. Even just a few months ago, Chris Thomas, a very well-known biodiversity scientist who's sort of explored questions of global change and other things, is suggesting that maybe invasive species aren't such a bad thing either, and uses an example that nearly 2,000 species have colonized Great Britain with none going extinct. Of course, Dan Cimberloff and Tim Caro and many others have responded quite angrily again to these problems. And so in our research, what we wanted to do was just say, hey, guys, this is ridiculous. There's a huge discrepancy in what you guys are comparing. And the point is simple. Muddy boots ecologists like myself and others, we're out there measuring quadrats, we're counting numbers of species in really small areas, and this is where the meta-analyses are going on. This is where the experiments are going on, and this is the very small scale. Dove Sachs and others, they're measuring much, much larger scales. They're measuring pixels on maps. They're measuring a variety of other much larger scale things. And richness means very different things at those different scales. Richness here is really about changes in relative abundances, where richness here means something more about maybe a regional extirpation or even a global extinction, even though those might not be obvious in many cases. So we can think about this in a very simplistic sort of species area curve way, where at the small scales, controls maybe have more species than an invaded community. At the larger scales, maybe they're not driving species extinct so much. And so now we have species area curves or some scaling relationship that we can compare. So I want to point this out because this is the take-home message for the talk. And if you want to, you know, go to sleep or think about something else after this, that's great. The bottom line is that species accumulation curves, these species area curves, are not parallel. Anytime some sort of ecological driver affects them, we change either the relative, we can change the density of individuals, and we change these slopes, but we change them in a non-parallel way. We can change the relative abundances of individuals, evenness. We change the slopes, but not parallel. Or we can change the clumping, the aggregation, the beta diversity, but they're not parallel. Okay? And I'll get into details of each one of those in a little bit. But the bottom line is, because they're not parallel, we can get different answers at different scales. This isn't just scale sometimes matters. This is scale always matters. We have to think about scale every time we measure biodiversity. We have to qualify it and quantify it in a scale-dependent way. So let me give you a little example. So this is an example where we start out with maybe a community here of dots. These are all individuals. Each color represents a different species. And we might draw, say, a species accumulation curve. We measure quadrats. As we go out, we find more and more species, and it levels off at some level. Now let's squash that community. Let's put an anthropogenic driver on that community. All I've done here is I've removed half of the individuals. Nothing specific to any particular species, just removed half of the individuals, and we shift the entire position of the species area curve. And what you can see here is you get a larger proportional effect size that you measure on a t-test or an ANOVA or a meta-analysis at small scales and a smaller proportional effect size at larger scales, because it just takes longer to find those rarest species. Okay? Very simple result, but actually very profound implications for our estimates of what we call effect size. And so here we've retaken those meta-analyses, those data that you saw before, and we've spread them out along a spatial scale. And of course there's a lot of scatter, but we find a negative relationship between the spatial scale at which a study is done and the effect of invasive species. So they're having much bigger effects in smaller quadrats. If you do your study at a bigger scale, you're much more likely to find weaker effects. So we wanted to actually look at this in a little bit more detail within a single system. And so living in Missouri, The Amur honeysuckle is one of our nastiest invaders. It's a shrub that's been present in our region for about 20, 30 years. Can form really dominant stands, but it's great because we can actually look for invasion fronts where we can find areas that haven't been invaded, but more or less have the same kinds of environmental conditions. We can measure the soil conditions and other things, and we can see lots of seedlings of the honeysuckle, but we're not seeing the dominance yet just because it hasn't gotten there yet. So what we did is we treated that as a bit of a natural experiment along this invasion front, and we measured the kinds of stuff that all of muddy boots ecologists study. You can see a huge sampling effect here underneath the canopy of the honeysuckle. And so what this led to was this scale-dependent differences in this impact of the invader. At small scales, we got a very strong, significant impact. At larger scales, the impact was no longer significant. So this is those data. Again, you can see the negative effect size as we increase sampling scale, the decreasing effect size. So we wanted to see how general this is, and we went to a few other sites that we happen to have research going on for other reasons, and we went to forests in the Big Island of Hawaii that were somewhere invaded by this nitrogen-fixing tree, and areas in Florida that were invaded by an Australian lily, and found very similar kinds of patterns, converging species area curves and declining effect sizes with scale. Okay. So now we have maybe some reconciliation for some of these problems. I just want to take a quick segue to a paper that was just published criticizing our study. I'll try not to be too defensive, but I do think there are some lessons here about big data. So these people were concerned a little bit that we were cherry-picking the examples, and we cherry-picked them clearly to illustrate this fundamental principle that we thought might be occurring. But they wanted to know how ubiquitous these factors were. And so they wanted to compare the intercepts and the slopes of those species area curves, the C and the Z in the species area curve. And so we predicted sort of an increase in the slope and a decrease in the intercept in these invaded communities. And they went to a much bigger data set across many, many states in the U.S. and found no correlation between the abundance, the percent cover of the invader, and either the slope or the intercept, and suggested these guys are wrong. This sort of ubiquitous pattern, this fundamental pattern, is just not true. They cherry-pick their examples. These haphazard studies are ridiculous. They need to start thinking about the more nuanced effect. And so I just want to point out that we really have to be careful when we think about biodiversity scaling. It's not just as easy as measuring species area curves. There's a lot under the hood. And that's where we get ourselves into trouble, especially under the hood when we start parameterizing things based upon log species area curves like C's and Z's. And so they suggested that they didn't see the pattern, and they said that, in fact, they did the same kinds of analyses that we did. So here, again, they have percent cover, so these are heavily invaded communities, very poorly invaded communities. And, of course, we know lots of stuff affects C, the numbers of species in any given area. Lots of stuff other than invaders, right? So this is a correlational study where there are many different things that are affecting C, disturbance, productivity, latitude, whatever. Lots of stuff, the same things that we know affect Z. And in fact, our data have the same exact variance if you look at C's and Z's because, of course, every system, every site has a different C if there's a different productivity regime or a different disturbance regime and so on and so forth. And if we analyze our data in the same exact way, we actually get no significant relationship. And so while they're claiming they're sort of analyzing scaling relationships in the same way we are, they're really missing the point of our study. It's not that there's a ubiquitous pattern, it's that we need to rethink about scale. That's the bottom line, is that we need to think about what's going into these C's and these Z's and all these kinds of things that we talk about, and what is driving the patterns of diversity, because diversity is really a conglomerate of relative abundances of species and their spatial distributions. It's populations. And so we really need to be more careful about how we consider these scaling relationships. Another thing that comes out of the simple idea of this nonlinearity in the species accumulation curve is that size of the species pool matters a whole lot for our implications of how we calculate effect sizes. So here's a big species pool and a small species pool, and these are identical in the impact. So here's a a happy, controlled community, and here's an impacted community. Same here. Okay, but our measured effect sizes are very different. So if I'm going to compare these two communities at the same scale, I'm going to assume that they're very different effect sizes, wherein in fact the effect size is identical. It's the ratios of my measurements that are changing. And so when I do a comparison, say along a latitudinal gradient, where I want to say, you know, maybe tropical areas are more resilient, or, you know, maybe plants are more resilient than animals or something like that, they're differing in their species pool. And so comparing these effect sizes can get us into a lot of trouble. Here's one example where one might look at, these are our data laid on top of the same meta-analysis that I showed you earlier. One might look at Hawaii and Florida and say, look at the huge impact on Hawaii compared to Florida. And that makes good sense. Hawaii is known to be this very, you know, fragile ecosystem. Islands in general are these fragile ecosystems, and so impacts of invaders could be much greater. But if we take the numbers of individuals into a rarefaction, in fact, Hawaii and Florida don't differ at all. It's just that they're changing in their species pools, they're differing in their species pools, and our perception of the effect size is very different. And so the implications of this, I think, are pretty important. When you see in the literature studies where maybe you're comparing birds and, bees and butterflies and their responses to, say, fragmentation, and you're seeing different effects, or you're comparing the responses of plants to nutrient addition across a gradient of light analysis, or you're comparing herbs versus, you know, you're comparing different kinds of species or different kinds of areas, and you're making conclusions that really have much more to do with the sampling than they might have to do with the biology. Okay, well, if we switch gears a little bit and we say, okay, well, so far I've just been talking about a very simplistic sampling effect. There hasn't been a lot of interesting biology going on. Let's start adding a little bit of interesting biology and see how we can extend these points. Now, we know global change often results in differential responses of species. So that impact that I gave you before was a random one, just sort of removed half the individuals randomly. Oftentimes, species respond differently. Some species don't like high fertilizer, some do. Some are fine with goats, some are less fine with goats, and so forth and so on. Well, what happens when we start changing these relative abundance patterns is that we get a very different effect. And we're going to talk about that in the context of habitat destruction, which is another one of these areas which Will Cove said is the most important factor changing biodiversity. But it turns out some annoying little scientists have been saying, hey, you know what, there's more going on here than that. A paper by Joe Wright and Helene Mueller-Landau suggested that maybe some of the predictions of biodiversity losses in tropical rainforests due to habitat destruction aren't so great, and they did some simple math to sort of suggest some reasons why. Bill Lawrence sort of fought back and said, in fact, you guys are wrong. These things are going to be really important. Again, making it into the popular press, making, you know, very interesting dialogue. Maybe, you know, the Chicken Little, you know, the sky is falling isn't so big of a deal. Maybe, maybe habitat loss isn't such a problem. More recently, Fanglang He and Steve Hubble have published a similar sort of analysis based on different kinds of analyses on the clumping and habitat destruction. But the idea is the same, that maybe we're overestimating species losses. A lot of people got very upset by these patterns and suggested maybe he and Hubble were missing a big part of the point. But again, these things start entering the popular press. So maybe we've bought ourselves a little time, as Steve Hubble says, or maybe we can hit the snooze on the ecological doomsday clock for a little while. Maybe it's not so big of a deal. Well, let's start talking about what habitat loss can do. One of the things, this is just a very simplistic idea, is that we often think habitat loss can have a disproportionate effect on rare species. We think that, you know, for whatever reason, rare species might be more susceptible to some of these global changes like habitat loss. Well, let's go ahead and do that. So we start out with our sort of pristine community. And here it's a little bit subtle, but all I've done is I've changed the evenness of the community. I've made it less even, okay? Dominated by a few species, the rare guys are doing worse. I shifted in the same way these species accumulation curves. Just by changing the evenness, I've now shifted this, and I'm seeing a larger effect at smaller sizes. smaller effects at larger sizes. And so we have these two very different mechanisms that can lead to similar-looking patterns of shifting species abundances. Now, last time I showed you that the effect sizes aren't very comparable across scale. Same is true when I change the species abundance distribution. But I showed you that when we rarefy richness, if you're only changing the density of individuals, that's what rarefaction does. It controls for that. And now my effect sizes are no longer scale dependent. Unfortunately, rarefaction doesn't work when you start changing relative abundances. Okay? Despite all of our sort of focus on rarefaction can control everything, and in fact doesn't control things, because what you're doing is you're comparing the difference here and the difference here at the numbers of individuals and the difference here. And those differences are still varying depending upon your sample scale. The good news is there is a metric that some smart people a long time ago started to think about. And this metric is sort of my new obsession, and I'm happy to talk more about this in the future and my talks and stuff with people. This is the idea of the probability of interspecific encounter, PIE. PIE was sort of developed by Hurlburt in a paper in the early 70s, but it's based on Simpson's Index. It's also called the Gini-Simpson's Index. And it's basically the idea that if you pull two individuals out of your community, what's the likelihood that they're going to be of the same species or not? And it's an index of evenness, okay? It basically tells me how even is my community. Mathematically, it's the slope at the base of the species accumulation curve. And so what's beautiful about this thing is that it's not dependent so much on sampling scale. And you can see that here, where the rarefied richness, again, dependent on sampling scale, but the probability of a specific encounter, and I've corrected for the effective number of species using just a simple conversion here. The probability of a specific encounter, this metric, differs between these two communities because they're different in their relative abundances. And now I have something that's a meaningful effect size. Okay? This meaningful effect size tells me, because richness is really just evenness when you're sampling at a small scale. They are completely, utterly correlated with one another. And so here I can now calculate this in a very scale-independent way. So let me show you how this works in a fragmentation study, habitat loss study. Here in St. Louis, of course, you could choose data from many other kinds of studies, but we just collected these data in our backyard. And you have very large fragments of many, many thousands of hectares and very small fragments. And we went out and we sampled plant diversity in a number of quadrats in each one of these sites. And these are the species accumulation curves in smallest fragments and the largest fragments. Okay? And the key thing to realize here is that at when I go out with a quadrat, a meter squared or 10 meter squared, and I average numbers of species per meter squared or numbers of species per 10 meter squared, I'm in here. And I'm not seeing a lot of difference. When I take the numbers of species per 100 meters squared, I'm out here and I'm seeing a much bigger difference. And you see this all of the time in the literature. You might draw, say, a species area curve across these fragments, and you get very different slopes simply depending upon my choice of how I aggregate those data. Am I aggregating them at the meter or 10 meter squared scale, or am I taking them all the way out to 100 meters? Very different effects. And I can do a regression, and I see much weaker effects at small spatial scales. And the reason is because of those rare guys. Right? I'm not sampling many of those rare guys here. Because I'm not sampling many of those rare guys here, I'm not seeing a big effect because they're the ones who are disproportionately responding to the environment. But if I look at this pi metric and I compare that across these fragments, I can get a much more stable estimate and show that, in fact, there is something different going on between these fragments. And the difference is that there's more rare species, proportionately more rare species in the bigger fragments. Not just more rare, because there's always going to be more rare species with sampling, but there's proportionately more. They're disproportionately affected by habitat loss. Okay? And now that I have this information, I can now ask really interesting biology. Before, I could ask that biology, but it wouldn't be relevant because I don't really trust my pattern. Now I can ask, why are rare species more affected by habitat loss? And there's a lot of good reasons why that might be so. It can be edge effects. It can be allele effects. It can be demographic stochasticity, herbivory, blah, blah, blah. It can be any number of these things, but I need to quantify this in order to be able to go there. And in fact, many people have looked at these kinds of questions before. This isn't necessarily new. We see this. You can see these species accumulations. This is in the biological dynamics of forest fragmentation in the Amazon that Lovejoy set up. These are species accumulations in the bigger fragments and in the smaller fragments. This is suggesting the same kind of pattern. You can use these data to now infer that rare species are being affected disproportionate to more common species. Similarly, Ellen Damshin and colleagues published a paper in experimental corridor study where they found and reported very strong effects of corridors on diversity. It turns out that this was at the sort of plot scale where they took the total numbers of species that they found in all of their quadrats. When they did a separate analysis in their supplementary material where they looked at the meter squared scale, which is what many of us often analyze our data on, and they found no effect whatsoever at the smaller scale. Okay, so maybe there's some generality here, but now we can also do some comparisons among other studies where we don't always see this effect. One of the sort of original experimental studies on habitat fragmentation in corridors, Gilbert and Andy Gonzalez and others, didn't find this kind of scale dependence that many of us are seeing. That's cool, because now we can interpret that as a real result that might be due to a real reason. In this case, maybe in their system, rare species weren't being disproportionately affected, but it had more to do with the sampling effect. That's what this effect would suggest. So now we can start maybe coming up with some generality in these meta-analyses. Okay, so the last thing that I want to talk about is a big, ugly thing that I'm not going to get into a lot of the details of, but as we start talking about scaling, I haven't mentioned the word beta diversity except once, I think. It's something that I used to think a lot about, but it turns out beta diversity is a very, very loaded concept. Usually when we think about beta diversity, and again, as somebody who comes at this from the muddy boots side of things, I'm interested in understanding patterns of community assembly. I'm interested in niches versus neutral or dispersal limitation, meta-communities, and so on and so forth. And so I'm interested in this clumpingness. Look, you can see this huge aggregations of these species on this California mountainside, whereas we might compare that, in this case, to grazed lands in Australia, much more homogenous, don't see that kind of clumping. And we can make some cool interpretations about why we see more beta diversity here than in here. Many kinds of questions that we can address about beta diversity with regards to this clumping and how that influences community assembly, how communities respond to environmental gradients and spatial gradients, and some great work sort of figuring out the statistics of how to do that. But there's a problem with our current conceptualization of what beta diversity is in the first place. And so I'm going to give you a quick little segue off into the world of the effects of productivity on diversity, which is another component. Many people have studied it in the context of global change, although it doesn't necessarily have to be global change. You can see differences between deserts and tropical rainforests because of productivity and the numbers of species, but you can also see it like in the experimental lakes where you fertilize a lake and you get these huge blooms of algae and you change diversity as a result. Okay. Note, this isn't diversity's effect on productivity. That's a whole different story that I'm not going to deal with. This is a causal productivity's effect on diversity. And we've been thinking about this problem for a very long time. Evelyn Hutchinson in his homage to Santa Rosalia, Robert MacArthur in a review paper, both said more productivity means more diversity. Jim Brown, after 20 years in the early 80s, said, this is a general rule, more productivity, more diversity. But about the same time in the early 80s, late 70s, Phil Grime, Dave Tillman, started saying, actually, we think we have some good reasons to suspect that these hump-shaped patterns. Mike Rosenzweig jumped on that and said, in fact, that's the real pattern. It's this hump-shaped pattern. That's where sort of you see the real productivity-diversity relationships. So to address some of these things, a variety of people have gotten together. One way to do it is this sort of global analysis, the NutNet project that some of you probably have heard of. Paper in Science a couple of years ago says that productivity is actually a terrible predictor of species richness across all of these sites. Interestingly, a couple of months later, some rebuttals came back and said, hey, you guys are wrong. If we squint and we, manipulate your data in this way, we actually see a positive relationship. These guys, I can't show you the data, but I can sort of give you the quote. These guys squinted in a different way, and they said, actually, we think the data from Adler have a strong sort of hump-shaped relationship. So even when we have these giant data sets, we don't have resolution to this debate. Well, can we resolve it with meta-analyses? NCS groups, one of the original NCS groups in the late 90s, a paper by Gary Mittelbach, tried to quantify how many papers show hump-shaped patterns, how many show positive, so on and so forth. And this has just led to a huge number of papers refining and reanalyzing and refining and reanalyzing these studies, leading Robert Whitaker to suggest, hey, wait a minute, you guys, this is getting ridiculous. First of all, the most important problem is that none of you guys are thinking about this issue of scale. I was quite pleased to see this because he cited a paper of mine prominently in recognizing that scale is a really important factor influencing these relationships. And the paper that we had originally published about 12 years ago now showed that you can see patterns, not always, but sometimes, like these hump-shaped patterns, when we sample diversity in a single pond. For example, in this case, productivity and diversity, I see sort of a nice hump-shaped pattern. But now, let's just take the same exact data, but lump them. And let's get up into our helicopter and look at it on a watershed scale. The same exact data give a very different result, okay? And so the only way that can happen is because of beta diversity, just mathematically. The only way you can get different patterns at local and regional scales is because something is going on with beta diversity. In this case, beta diversity has to be higher at higher productivity in order to see that sort of that real pull where it's really pulling these really low diversity values to really high diversity values at the regional scale. It's because there's got to be a lot of beta diversity running around in there. Well, everybody jumped on this one in two and said, hey, let's see if we can start exploring these patterns in other kinds of systems. And one of the best papers that I can see, not to kiss too much butt here, but it really is a great paper by Andy and one of his students, across a variety of lakes, found, you know, good confirmation that these more productive, more energetic lakes had higher levels of biodiversity. But there's a lot of studies that disagree with that. Ian Donahue and others in lakes in Great Britain found that actually communities became more homogeneous with higher productivity. Okay, so that's opposite to what we're showing. And some studies find both patterns. This is a sort of a meta-analysis Dave Childcraft and other folks did, where they found increases in beta diversity when you added nutrients in some cases, and decreases in beta diversity when you added nutrients in other cases. And they tried to relate this to something like what's going on in the controls, what's the productivity of that system in the first place. But let's take a step back. What is this thing that we call beta diversity? It's pretty cool. It's useful because it's a good way to scale local and regional. And, you know, rather than having to deal with this ugly sort of curve, we can just take two points. We can take a smaller and a bigger, and we can say there's some beta diversity. Now, of course, that's a huge loaded term in and of itself. And that's so the good is, yes, we have a good scaling. We can say some cool things about what is causing that beta diversity, environment, space, and so forth. The bad is we don't even agree on how to write that equation. Is it alpha plus beta equals gamma or alpha times beta equals gamma? We're still fighting about these things. We know there are dozens of metrics used to describe this pattern. We're getting some good idea of which ones are really terrible and which ones are better, but there's still, if you look at the literature or papers published coming across my desk as an editor and reviewer and so forth, people are all over the board on which metrics they're using. And so while we want to say something about community assembly, there's a lot that's underneath. And the bigger problem is that this nonlinearity is even more loaded than we would like to admit. And here's one way it can do so. So when we think of beta diversity, we usually think of this clumping, this aggregation. You like wet areas and I like dry areas, so you're going to be over there and I'm going to be over here, and we're clumped. Or maybe there's dispersal limitation, and I'm over here because I can't disperse over there, and you're over there because either way, it's clumping in the environment that's creating this beta diversity. And so here, if we take our control community, and this is a little subtle, you can't really see it, but all I've done is I've just moved things around spatially. I haven't changed anything about how many individuals there are. I've just moved them around. We got that same kind of pattern where we get This nonlinear species accumulation curves, non-parallel, larger effects at small scales, smaller effects at big scales. And this is because they've been clumped, and so some of those rare species I'm not going to find if I'm measuring over here. I'm only going to find them when I go over there. And so if I'm sampling small scales, I'm going to miss some of those species that are clumped over there. Okay? So now we have three different things that create very similar patterns. We have this abundance or density effect. We have the relative abundance effect, the species abundance distribution or evenness. And we have this clumping effect. But when we talk about beta diversity, at least me, I think most of us probably have in our mind the real biology, right? The community assembly responding to dispersal or environment. And so this is the stuff we want. And this is the ugly stuff on the outside of our measurements of beta diversity. Invariably in our measurements on beta diversity, no matter how good our sampling is, it's still local sampling, right? So I could sample every single stem in 50 hectares, but it's still just 50 hectares, right? And so this is the stuff we want, and these are the things that are just affecting our measurements. The other thing is the sort of scale and extent can play a huge role, again, because of this nonlinearity. So let's take our control and our impacted community, and let's measure alpha and beta diversity here. And I've done this stuff. I can point to some of my data and show you where I've misinterpreted the results. Because I chose to treat alpha diversity here and gamma diversity here, I found an increase in beta, or higher beta here and lower here. But what if I chose over here? I'd get the exact opposite result. And again, I'm not going to get into that, but I could show you exactly where this turns out in some of my data. If I change the size of the species pool, it gets even worse, where two species pools can show you different answers, even though they're both responding in the same exact way, because of the ratios of the sort of regional to local. The good news is this pi thing seems to play a role helping us understand bits about beta diversity. And the way it can do so, and I'll just overview this very quickly since I'm running out of time, but this is pi measured in the sort of observed community. Let's just say we start out with a reasonably clumped community. There's a wet side and a dry side, and the white species over here likes the wet side, and the blue species over here likes the dry side. And so my probability of a specific encounter, if I take any small sample, isn't going to necessarily include the guy in the other part of the clump. Okay, so I'm going to get a lower pi. Where if I take those things and I randomize them, I'm going to get a higher pi because of that they're basically being spread equally throughout the environment. I lose that aggregation. I've disentangled the aggregation. If I take the difference between these two pis, I now have an index of aggregation where I've sliced out that other stuff that I don't want, which is the abundances, the total abundances and the relative abundances. Okay, and here's an example of how this can work in these pond communities. This is an experiment that I did a few years ago where I added nutrients to certain cattle tanks and not to others. And these are four cattle tanks that have the same exact environment but look very different in their community composition. So there's a lot of beta diversity. So if you look at, and this is richness, on a per pond basis, there's no effect in this case of fertilization on local richness. But there's a big effect of fertilization on regional richness when I add up a bunch of those ponds in the community. And this is what we would interpret as beta diversity. It's a raw bit of the beta diversity. And again, there's a billion different ways we could measure that. But what if we take this idea of pi and we look at the pi effect again? These are the relative abundances. And we compare at local and regional scales. We see that that is emerging because of the clumping. The clumping is emerging, giving us this beta diversity being higher in the high productivity than the lower productivity. Now, the effect is much smaller than what I showed you earlier, but I've sliced out those other components, those sort of interesting but not the same kinds of biology. Those components are interesting, but they're not the same biology. Okay? And so now we have a metric where we can look at this aggregation. And now beta diversity, again, is a huge bandwagon. I am sorry to say that I've played a role in adding, I think, to the confusion as much as helping relieve it, because there are many of these metrics that I've been working on and analyzing that I think can still hide some of these differences. So when we look into the literature and we see people looking at things like urbanization or road building or dam building or agriculture, and we start measuring sort of homogenization and saying, because it's homogenizing, that's bad for regional biodiversity, we can't really quantify that yet without sort of slicing that a little bit deeper and slicing what role these homogenization processes are having on abundances and relative abundances, which are still interesting, but they're not beta diversity in the way that we often think about it, or this aggregation bit, which is where we are then going to try to interpret community assembly, niche limitation, dispersal limitation, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so to wrap up, I think the conclusion that I've sort of come to myself and I'm hoping to convince you of is that, yeah, we know there are biodiversity declines, but we also know that our ability to quantify these things, if we really want to say, you know, X percent, we're not there yet. And maybe that's even not an interesting question, but we might want to still compare sort of the relative effects on different types of species, different types of systems. And at the moment, most of our tools are unable to do this. Because we need to recognize that biodiversity is not a concept. If it's species richness or if it's Shannon diversity, it's not a real concept because it always has to be qualified. And we say it, but we just forget about it. It always has to be qualified by at a scale, numbers of species in a area. We always, it's implicit, but we need to make that explicit because our effect sizes change depending upon how we define that. And so I think we need to recognize that, in fact, biodiversity is a conglomerate estimate of really all the populations that are in the system, and we're just lumping them together. And so if we understand what's going on with populations in terms of their densities, their relative abundances, and their clumping in space, we can start to disentangle a little bit about what's going in to those biodiversity metrics. And so I like this pi metric, and I hope it might help tease this out a little bit further. Thank you. Can just yell.
Okay, so thank you very much, John, for an extremely interesting and indeed mind-blowing talk. I guess I have one comment to offer and welcome you to say what you want about it, and then also a more specific question that relates to the Stolgren-Ridgemanic. So I wonder if we might be able to, is that like 1,000 slides ago?
Yeah, it's just all that stupid animation.
But it has to do with kind of the overall picture of, you know, what is happening to biodiversity, is it a big deal or not? And I guess my two thoughts about that are that when there are really differences between what's going on at the really small scale and what's going on at the very large scale, obviously it's the large scale that matters. I mean, ultimately,
why
global biodiversity is what really matters.
I would disagree with
that. That's a statement, and I'll welcome you to refute it.
Anybody who studies diversity ecosystem function would probably disagree with that, because ecosystem function is usually a much more local process. Not always, but it's about, you know, the diversity, and, you know, if you want to talk about nutrient cycling or productivity or whatever, local scale stuff is, you know, or dilution effect with disease dynamics, for example,
okay,
can also be very local.
Right.
Okay. So I didn't mean to cut you off, but
no. I think those are good points. I guess I just wanted to mention two very broad. I mean, there are many, but just two that I've found very striking recently that are very broad global scale measures of what's happening to biodiversity. One of them is the Living Planet Index that looks at vertebrate populations because those are the best sampled, but showing, you know, I think even conservatively, that between 1970 and 2008, on average, vertebrate populations declined by 30%. You know, it's a geometric mean, et cetera. So even though there can be discrepancies between local and global pictures, there are some pretty disturbing measures of what's happening at the global level. Even more disturbing for me, it looks like, and again talking about vertebrates, 97% of all vertebrate biomass on Earth is composed of humans and our livestock. And I can
kind of back that statistic up. That, to me, that's just profoundly disturbing. 80,000 species of vertebrates, and we make up 97% of the biomass.
The same is true in tropical rainforests. People are finding, I mean, there are always some dominant species. We just happen to be the dominant ones at the moment.
Okay. So maybe it's no big deal.
I'm not saying that at all.
I find it profound and disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the I guess the more specific question is with regard to this particular study, could you imagine control variables that would allow that? I think the general point that when you get a non-statistical result, it doesn't mean very much. It's not very powerful. But could you imagine any, you know, kind of statistical controls that would allow the real patterns that you say are there to emerge even in a data set like that?
And let me qualify. I'm delighted for our patterns to not show up. I mean, I think it's interesting when they don't show up for good reasons. In this case, there's not a good reason, or at least we don't know it. There are many reasons why. For example, there are cases where invasive species can facilitate diversity. It can increase C. Great. I mean, maybe not great, but it's interesting and useful to know that. And so in this case, yeah, it would require something like a structural equation model, something where you can, they're treating this x-axis as an independent variable, where it's clearly not, and it's clearly affecting and affected by the diversity that is quantifying the C's and the Z's. And so what you'd need to do is sort of look at some environmental drivers, productivity, whatever, and then have invasive species as a driver, an independent variable, but also a dependent variable as a result of environment. And then the native species diversity would result from the interaction between those drivers and the invaders, right? And so by having just a triangle, sort of a three-way interaction, you could probably tease it apart in a slightly better way. I mean, there's still statistical issues, but that's the way you could do that. I mean, to your bigger question, I hope that I didn't imply that I don't think biodiversity is a problem. I just think that we don't have a good way to quantify it. And it leaves us open to criticism and to holes and to fuzzy thinking that we really need to do a better job at quantifying these things if we're going to back up some of these things. And I think this vertebrate reduction is a good way. That's populations. I'm a community ecologist. I love communities. But I've come to realize that, you know, our metrics aren't very useful because they're conglomerates of smaller scale metrics like populations. Let's understand what's going on with populations, and then we can understand a lot more.
On the question of metrics and on the question of scale, considering how little we know about biodiversity in the oceans and their effects on the world's oxygen supply, how does one solve the problem of scale and metrics in dealing with what's happening in the oceans?
Well, I mean, I guess, is your question sort of, are we increasing, decreasing, changing ocean diversity, presumably?
Well, that's photosynthesizers. I'm suggesting that we're much in the dark in the whole area, and yet we spend most of our time and resources dealing with land and regional areas,
right,
despite the fact that the big elephant is out there,
right,
and we seem to ignore it. So how does one manage to do something about it?
Well, I think in this case, one of the biggest problems with, I think, what you're bringing up is in order to really, I think, do the analyses well, and especially the beta diversity analyses, is that we need good taxonomy. I know, I'm sorry, I'm kissing butt here, but yes, we need good taxonomy because we need to know if it's the same thing over there that's over there. And a lot of our analyses, you know, especially in these hyper-diverse systems or when we're not taking it out to enough of a resolution, we're not sure what, you know, if what we have locally is the same as what we have regionally. And so in terms of quantifying these more sort of cryptic type communities, at least we currently don't have a good view of, if we want to quantify change, we need to have good taxonomic resolution, and then you can set up the networks that I know ocean people have already set up, if they can actually compare across systems, and then you can sort of use this moving window analysis to see what's happening to diversity, you know, at different scales as you go up.
Thank you.